Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
And we have little flag things.
Square Pod Save the World for the YouTube audience.
Yeah.
Pod Save the World things.
Hey, you're welcome, audience.
Yeah.
Ben, feisty State of the Union. When we were talking about it that day, I did not expect Joe Biden to come out swinging.
Yeah, I don't know if Dr. Ronnie's back in the White House.
come on. Yeah. He never left.
Fiery, every single headline was like, fiery this, fiery that.
Yeah.
But essentially what they did is they picked like 10 to 15 fights and just, you know, put them together in one speech.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that very well-meaning but annoying lawyers would have told us we were not allowed to do in the Obama days.
That's true, actually. There was not a lot of hesitancy to draw contrast, which, again, like, I think it's the right move. And it's an election year, so you have to do it. And it's the reality. And frankly, on things like Ukraine, I mean, it's also legislative. You know, it's like
they're
blocking legislation. You know, I'm sorry you don't like being called out on that. Mike Johnson looked like he was kind of receding back into his chair and growing smaller throughout the course of
the day.
Very sad Mike Johnson.
Yeah, but the whole idea of, like, I don't even remember what constitutes a Hatch Act violation necessarily, but Trump hosted the RNC from the White House grounds, so I feel like that should sort of end the discussion.
Well, I know. We used to get all these ethics briefings, and then this guy's, like, literally having his political convention on the South Lawn and tweeting out images of the PDB from his
classified Iran details, Anyway, well, we're going to talk about the State of the Union a bit more because we're going to talk about Biden's new plan to get aid into Gaza that he laid out in that speech, Biden's Rafah red line, and Netanyahu's rebuke to basically all U.S. policy, current and past. We'll also talk about Trump's fake state visit with Viktor Orban down in Florida and why Viktor Orban matters and we talk about him so much. We'll get into the fight in Congress over banning TikTok, some big political news out of Portugal and Turkey, kidnappings for ransom in Nigeria, and an embarrassing failed effort to amend Ireland's constitution. And then what everyone's been waiting for, Ben, the Photoshop saga heard round Kensington Palace.
Don't worry, we're going to spend a good bit of time.
I'm hoping for like 40 minutes.
We may need, you know, I almost proposed a bonus pod
just on the Photoshop.
Thankfully it was close enough to Tuesday that I thought, you know, in good conscience, I could wait.
Not to get ahead of ourselves, but someone tweeted out a picture of King Charles with the caption, "I too like to play with Photoshop," and they just put like a pack of sausages for his hands. Some really good comedy here.
Oh god.
And then Ben, you just did our interview. What are folks going to hear?
Yeah, I talked to Renata Segura, who is the deputy director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the International Crisis Group. We talked about Haiti, obviously a horrific situation, and I thought it'd be good to have someone come on and really break down what is happening in Haiti, who are the key players, why are the gangs making their move now, what can be done internationally, what should the U.S. be doing, what should the political transition be in Haiti. The prime minister is now acceded to this pressure to step aside. So it's a really good laydown of what's happening, and I wish there was better news, but there's not. It's pretty grim.
It is dark, man.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, I mean, just watching the reports of the gangs attacking the airports, you know, taking over basically all of the capital, it's really scary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, from talking to Renata, and ICG's had a person on the ground in Port-au-Prince, that essentially the gangs control the city pretty much now, which is terrifying.
Yeah. One thing before we get to our news on Gaza, I just did want to give a shout out to Mstislav Chernov, the Ukrainian journalist and director of the film 20 Days in Mariupol, which is about the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion back in 2022. The film won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. He was a guest on the show on February 21st, so I think that had something to do with it.
Can I make a point here?
Yeah,
this is the second year in a row, because we had
That's
the Navalny director and some of the Navalny film participants on for last year's Oscars, and they won. So Pod Save the World, 2 for 2, all you publicists out there.
I was going to say, Hollywood
keep in
PR
mind
people.
Who delivers the Oscar. It is this podcast.
Yeah, you're trying to sell some new Matt Damon movie?
No.
Come get
here.
Him on here.
Come here. Yeah, get Matt Damon on.
That's what I'm talking about. All right, Matt, we'll talk about
Tom Brady. Or go fuck yourself.
let's go to Gaza in the State of the Union. Yeah. So, okay, in the State of the Union, President Biden announced that the U.S. is planning to build a floating pier off the Gaza coast to facilitate aid deliveries into Gaza. It's going to take about 60 days or at least 60 days to construct this pier. Biden says no U.S. boots will be on the ground in Gaza. So it's not clear to me, Ben, who's going to distribute the aid, who will provide security over this entire operation. You have to imagine after Afghanistan and the tragedy at the Abbey Gate where a suicide bomber killed 13 U.S. service members, injured hundreds more people, the Biden team is going to be extremely worried about the safety of the people involved in this operation. There was a report in the Jerusalem Post over the weekend that said that the idea for delivering aid by sea actually came from Netanyahu himself. That it was raised as far back as October, was discussed by Biden and Bibi directly in January. So I don't know if that's true or not. Netanyahu refusing to let more aid trucks into Gaza because the Israeli far right opposes it, and then forcing the U.S. to construct a floating pier to, you know, bail him out kind of tracks with how he operates. But I don't know, what do you make of this proposal?
I mean, look... On the one hand, anything that can facilitate the delivery of aid into Gaza makes sense to explore. If this gets more aid into Gaza more efficiently from Cyprus, which is where a lot of this aid comes from, that could help. That said, this is one of those announcements that, again, highlights the shortcomings of the existing policy, though, because clearly it'd be more efficient to just drive trucks across the border in Rafah. I mean,
trucks that are waiting there.
Yeah.
Ready to cross.
So you're basically spending a lot of money and time, and you don't have time, by the way, 2 months, you know, you've got famine conditions already before an Israeli military operation in Rafah. It would be better if you want to get aid in to just drive trucks in across the border from Rafah. And I guess you can't do that if the Israeli military operation is going to go forward in Rafah. But if the U.S. wants to get aid in, that's what I would be doing. This feels like, once again, we're kind of adding on to a policy that is not addressing the underlying issue, which is the military operation, the need for a ceasefire to get aid in. That's the first point. The second point is that on the administration of this, you know, the U.S., I think, is still not kind of turned back on the UNRWA funding, which we talked about. Other countries have started to do this, by the way. I think Canada recently joined.
Sweden, yeah.
Canada and Sweden. UNRWA has the capacity to deliver aid. All the aid delivery mechanisms in Gaza have been through UNRWA for years. And the idea that we're shutting all that down to investigate these few people that were involved in October 7th, when, again, as we talked about, there are thousands and thousands of UNRWA employees. Again, we're building a pier while we're like cutting off the aid delivery people in Gaza and not driving trucks across the border. I mean, again, glad to have the pier, but that's really not going to make the difference that's necessary here. And you know, I think that's why, you know, they're in that circumstance where the policies are not making anybody happy. You know, and that's why I think you've had a bit of a lukewarm reaction to this. You know?
Yeah. And did you see that Netanyahu is basically denying that there's near famine conditions? He did this long interview with Politico that we'll get into. He said, quote, we don't have that kind of information. That's not the information we have. And we monitor it closely. More importantly, it's not our policy. Our policies are to put in as much humanitarian aid as we could. That's just absolutely
not true. Their own leadership was saying things like no food. You know, they were announcing the policy of cutting off food and fuel into Gaza.
Right. And there's right-wing protesters blocking these aid deliveries and preventing them from happening.
Yeah. And so you and I have talked again about this, but his ability to go on U.S. media in particular and just kind of lie about things and do it in, you know, accessible language for the American audience is part of his selling point back home. I'll be the front man for the far right in this country. You'd rather have me on TV in the U.S. than Ben-Gvir. That's kind of his last argument for being prime minister. And unfortunately, it seems to be working for the guy right now.
Yeah. And so, again, listeners of this show will not be surprised to hear that Biden and Netanyahu are not aligned on the big policy questions. But that fact was spelled out again over the weekend in these a pair of interviews. So the first big difference is over the potential Israeli invasion of Rafah, which is that city in southern Gaza where 1.4 million people are sheltering. And as Ben just mentioned, where aid crosses from Egypt into Gaza. During an interview with MSNBC on Saturday, President Biden said an Israeli invasion of Rafah was a red line for him. Here's a clip.
I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to get to deal with. With the trauma caused by Hamas.
Sort of like redline-ish.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I don't know if he meant to state it exactly as he did.
It's but like a highlighter.
Basically
sort of like
saying blurry line. If there are another 30,000 people killed on top of the already 30,000 people killed, then that'd be a red line. I mean, it didn't. I don't know. They kind of walked back the idea of a red line. And
I think the U.S. press has gotten addicted to the
idea
red
lines,
of fucking
red
line.
No president should ever say the word red line.
I'll never repeat that again.
But look, what I take away from it substantively is he's trying to say that the Israeli military operation in Rafah would be some kind of breaking point vis-a-vis Netanyahu. I think the question is, well, first of all, I think that should have already happened. We've talked about, and in prepping for the show, Tommy, I mean, it's frustrating. We've been talking about these differences on the military operation Rafah and the Palestinian state issue for a long time. These differences have been pretty, obvious, staring us in the face for a while. And the challenge here is that they seem to not want to admit that they need to change their policy, And you and I have been in the White House. It's hard to come out and say, you know what, we tried it this way. We tried to kind of hug Bibi and counsel him in private, and that didn't work, and so now we're changing. And instead, you're always kind of trying to explain why this is no.
Yeah,
this
is an inflection
this
point.
This is an evolution of the policy.
Yep,
and
yep.
But I think what he's saying is that there'll be some consequence if the military operation Rafah goes forward. What that consequence is, I mean, he kind of for the first time hinted at certain restrictions on weapons. I mean, because he notably said, I would never cut off the Iron Dome.
It's a missile defense.
Which is missile defense.
Which, like, that's defensible.
Nobody has said, Bernie Sanders, who's been the most outspoken and I think in line with our position in terms of saying cut off military assistance, even Bernie said, we can keep giving them the Iron Dome because you want to protect against rockets. But the question is, would you cut off all offensive military assistance? I think you should. Would you vote for a ceasefire resolution at the United Nations? I think you should. I think we should be doing that now, frankly. Yeah. So the question remains for Biden. One, does the military operation Rafah go forward? And if it does, how substantive is this break? I think, just saying we don't like this and we don't like Netanyahu is not going to cut it anymore and never was going to cut it.
Yeah, and it gets worse. I mean, so on Sunday, Netanyahu was asked about Rafah during this interview he did with Axel Springer, which is the parent company of Politico. When asked about a Rafah invasion, he said, we'll go there. We're not going to leave them, them being the remaining Hamas forces in Rafah. Netanyahu then seemed to respond to Biden's red line comments. Here's a clip.
We'll go there. We're not going to leave them. I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7th doesn't happen again, never happens again. And to do that, we have to complete the destruction of the Hamas terrorist army.
In that interview, Bibi also firmly rejected a two-state solution, saying, quote, the Israeli people also support my position that says that we should resoundingly reject the attempt to ram down our throats a Palestinian state. That is something that they agree on. So to your point, Ben, Axios reported that if Israel does go into Rafah, the U.S. is considering imposing restrictions on some U.S.-made weapons by the IDF. They're considering not vetoing a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. But again, I'm with you. Like, I would like to see those steps taken now to prevent this Rafah operation from happening. And there's just kind of no one seems to address the broader, more substantive break on the creation of a Palestinian state. And, they haven't even, like, Bibi and Biden have not spoken in nearly a month. They're clearly not aligned on short-term and long-term strategy. And yet, it, like you said, it does feel like the U.S. policy is kind of just on autopilot.
It's on autopilot. And again, it's because you would have to acknowledge that the approach of hugging Bibi, which is literally their stated policy, hasn't worked. Do you want to hug that guy? I don't want to hug that guy.
No, he's creepy as fuck.
He's creepy as fuck. And like he's saying, you know, this red line, you know, macho talk that he does, they don't need to invade Rafah to prevent October 7th from happening. You know, the October 7th happened because Bibi fucked up. Because Bibi let his guard down. Because Bibi moved a bunch of troops from the border with Gaza up to chase around settlers who were committing violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. So what Rafah would do is cause a humanitarian catastrophe. And look, in terms of the bigger picture here, politically, first of all, Tommy, I'm beginning to have nightmares about what a tragic irony it would be if an American Democratic president lost re-election because he was unwilling to fully break with Bibi Netanyahu. You know, that's kind of my worst nightmare in life. But I think that's a real consideration. Obviously, more substantively importantly is the humanitarian situation and the policy. And I think what the U.S. needs to do is actually start working on behalf of its own policy. Right now, it's been trying to kind of convince Israel to support things that Bibi doesn't support. You know, don't go into Rafah, support a Palestinian state. We should have a view. Like, we want to move aid into Rafah with trucks. We want to start working for the construction of a Palestinian state, which has been U.S. policy for over two decades.
Yeah.
You know, this is not ramming down the throat something that the whole world has supported for a very long time. And just start working in that direction. You know, and if you have to work around Bibi, you have to work around him. Would I prefer an Israeli government that is a partner in that? Sure. And by working around it, I mean just what is a vehicle for getting aid into Gaza? What is the kind of work that needs to be done to build up an alternative Palestinian leadership? What is the option on the table for some kind of recognition, de facto or more specific, of Palestinian borders for a state? These are things where the U.S. can have a view. And just thinking you're going to get Bibi to go along with it. I mean, this guy's going to –
He's full of shit.
He wants Joe Biden to lose the election.
He does. He said not going to Rafah would be the equivalent of Allied forces in World War II not going to Berlin. That is the craziest comparison I've ever heard.
Like, yeah.
Berlin, post-World War I Germany is not the same as a couple million people who are trapped in a tiny little sliver of
Gaza Strip. Largely civilians,
Also, Ben, you and I, you know, we have both dealt with the people online who constantly suggest that, like, all the death tolls that come out of Gaza are made up because it's from the Hamas-run health ministry. In that interview that Netanyahu did with Axel Springer, he says that Israel has killed 13,000 Hamas fighters, and that they've also killed maybe 1 to 1.5 civilians per combatant, which would put the total number of deaths at 26,000, which is right around where the Hamas health ministry says. Everyone who's watching this closely thinks the actual death toll is much, much higher than that. But for all the truthers out there, Bibi Netanyahu thinks that at least 26,000 people have been killed in this conflict in 5 months.
And 15,000 children have been killed. So the Hamas combatant figure doesn't add up, you know, unless you think a bunch of, you know, I mean, it's gross that we're arguing about what, you know, how many children is enough for you? You know, like what is too much? I mean, this is not working, people, you know? And again, we've said this every time, and I say it again, like the hostages, if that's your concern, you're not going to get them. You're not going to free them more efficiently through invading Rafah than you would through a negotiation.
But, yeah. You know. Two other strange things. So in that interview, Netanyahu seemed to leave open the possibility of extending military operations into Lebanon. Yeah. Because the people who evacuated northern Lebanon want to go home. But he said, you know, if we need to make sure they're safe through military means, we'll do so. The other strange thing that happened today. So every year, the intelligence community does this annual threat assessment where they release this 40-page unclassified document of all the threats in the world. And then they testify. And it's this bizarre... I don't know why they do it, to be totally honest.
To give the press like scary stories to write for a couple of days.
Yeah, justify their budgets. Yeah. But in the threat assessment document that came out on Monday, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, cited concerns about distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule, and it questioned his viability as a leader as well as his governing coalition going forward, which was noticed and not appreciated by Netanyahu's government.
But you've also seen huge protests in Israel against Netanyahu's government. I mean, thousands and thousands of people on the street demanding elections on the basis that Netanyahu failed and kind of lost his legitimacy because of what happened on October 7th. And obviously, because he's flailing around now. And so, you know, this is not just the opinion of the U.S. intelligence community. Netanyahu's approval ratings have been very low. He clearly doesn't have the confidence of a large number of the Israeli people, even Israeli people who may support a military operation. So, you know, it's one of those. I mean, the other thing that was in that threat report is that the United States might face an increased threat around the world because of its support for Israel, which, again, is not a surprise. But, you know, some things are, you know, need to be stated, obviously.
Yeah. One last clip that's worth hearing from Biden's interview on MSNBC.
What's happening is he has a right to defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world. It's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake.
I mean, accurate, a good observation. I just, you know, I think that needs to be, if you really think he's hurting Israel, then let's back that with action. I think that's sort of the final word.
Yeah, we're not a passive actor. I mean, the final word I'd say is that we're supplying a lot of, if not most of the offensive weapons that they're using to hurt Israel. So it, you know, it's not just commenting on something that we are not a part of. You know, we should be able to use our leverage if we think what they're doing is wrong. You know, the substance has to follow that comment, you know?
Yeah. Well, hopefully there'll be better news on this next week. I mean, Everyone was hoping there'd be a ceasefire before Ramadan.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, let's hope that they pull that off.
Fingers crossed.
That'd be the best possible outcome.
Okay, Ben, let's turn to Mar-a-Lago because we talk a lot about Hungarian dictator, soft fascist, is what people like to call him, Viktor Orban on the show. We cover him for a bunch of reasons. He's a Putin stooge. He's a huge pain in the ass for the European Union, for NATO. He was at the vanguard of demagoguing Muslims and refugees to gain political power. And he's also seen by conservatives, especially Republicans in the U.S., as the model for how to crush democracy, cement your control over a country, and pervert or destroy its institutions. So, again, that brings us to Mar-a-Lago, where Trump hosted Orban and his daughter for like a pretend state visit last week.
Yeah.
Here's a clip of Trump praising Orban to the assembled audience.
There's nobody that's better, smarter, or a better leader than Viktor Orban. He's fantastic. He's as you know, the Prime Minister of Hungary, and does a great job. He's a non-controversial figure because he said this is the way it's going to be, and that's the end of it, right? He's the boss. And you know, he's a great leader, fantastic leader in Europe and all over the world.
The music just softly playing.
The soul man. I'm a big Sam and Dave guy, but like...
he also just sounds so jealous whenever he's talking about like Xi Jinping any dictator that could just rule by fiat. Yeah. Anyway, so Orban, you know, does the whole reach around on social media afterward. He says Trump commanded respect in the world, created the conditions for peace during his presidency. There was peace in the Middle East and peace in Ukraine. We need him back more than ever. Orban also told Hungarian state media that Trump is a man of peace. He will not give a penny in the Ukraine-Russia war. Therefore, the war will end because it's so obvious that Ukraine cannot stand on its own feet. So, I don't know. Like, everything about this is just so weird. You're just doing a cosplay state visit at Mar-a-Lago. Everything from, like, the arrival photos to the flags to the motorcades driving up.
To the Sam and Dave soundtrack. You know?
Just don't know what to make of this.
All right. Oh, I haven't done a book plug in a while. Okay.
Go for it.
But, you know, to those of you who are newer worldos, I wrote a book a few years ago now. God, we're getting old. Called After the Fall, about the rise of authoritarianism in the world. And it had started with a huge section on Hungary because Hungary is the template that Republicans have used. And again, to be specific, the way that started is, you know, essentially Orban gets elected. His second term time in as prime minister in 2010 and, you know, packs the court with right-wing judges, redraws the parliamentary districts to entrench his party in power, changes the voting laws to make it easier for his supporters to vote and, you know, harder for his opponents to vote, enriches some cronies through corruption who then finance all of his politics, buy up the media and turn it into kind of a right-wing mouthpiece, use social media to villainize his opponents, and wraps it all up in a big old nice bow of us versus them nationalism, you know, us, the true Hungarians and them.
Real Hungarians.
Yeah, the real Hungarians versus the you know, liberal elites and the Muslims and the, you know, immigrants and George Soros. So it sounded very familiar. In other words, like, this literally is the playbook, the exact playbook that the Republican Party's been running in this country. They want to turn this country into a one-party autocracy that has the veneer of elections, but essentially all the levers to power are corruptly controlled by their party. So we need to take this seriously, because this is like having Mussolini at the White House in the 30s. You know, like,
George Bush refused to meet with Viktor Orban.
Yes, yeah.
He wouldn't invite him for a state visit.
Yeah,
Trump did in 2019.
Yeah, this is crazy shit. You know, and you know, it's all normalized, but like, literally, this is, you know, announcing your intention to be a soft authoritarian, not even soft, really. Viktor Orban can be pretty hard assed about it. Never mind the fact that, you know, cutting off all aid to Ukraine, and quote unquote, ending the war, ending, you know, Ukraine's capacity
ending
to resist Vladimir Putin. So these are things that have like very high stakes, and sometimes they can seem less like that because there's like this kind of comical facade of Mar-a-Lago and the soul man playing in the backdrop. But like, you know, I think I'd take it pretty seriously, you know.
It's just, yeah, it is worth watching. I mean, it's CPAC and all these other events. Javier Milei, I think, went to Mar-a-Lago. There's just this little crew of kind of populist right-wing dictators is always getting together. And it's not just Trump. I mean, Viktor Orban was in D.C. the day of Biden's State of the Union giving a speech to the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, and this is to build on what we were saying after CPAC. I'd like to see the center-left and progressives and even, like, you know, the occasional mods get each other's back like this. You know, these people are not – Viktor Orban is not nervous about defying Joe Biden and endorsing Donald Trump. Like, we should do more – in this country and around the world to kind of spotlight, support, platform good leaders of even smaller countries. You know, they've gone a long way to building up Viktor Orban and his stature globally. We don't do the same thing when we have like a, you know, a Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, or you've had some pretty good leaders recently in Central and Eastern Europe. Like, we got some good young progressive leaders in Latin America. I'd just like to see us do more to support one another in the way that they do, maybe without the Mar-a-Lago backdrop and the Soul Man soundtrack.
Yeah, but maybe you don't need
Soul Man. I mean, I like Soul Man. Salmon Davis, you know, it's Hold On, I'm Coming, or is it Soul? Yeah, sorry, it's Hold On, I'm Coming. I don't know why I keep saying Soul Man.
I don't know. I don't know the names of any songs. Spotify pumps into my brain.
Well, I just had, I had that cassette. I'm old enough that the Blues Brothers soundtrack, you know, had a bunch of Sam and Dave, the best of Sam and Dave. Hold On, I'm Coming, Soul Man, like a bunch of good tracks on there. So I recommend that.
Also old enough to remember when people freaked out about the Logan Act and, you know, people pretending they were conducting foreign policy on behalf
John
of the United
Kerry,
States.
John Kerry, like, met some European once during the Trump years.
Yeah, they're ready to
throw him in prison.
Behead the guy.
And meanwhile, Donald Trump is like undermining U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Orban's like, oh, yeah, I'll cut off all aid to Ukraine. In more Ukraine news, just worth quickly pointing out that the Ukrainian government is furious at the Pope for seeming to suggest that they should surrender. The Vatican says the Pope was just advocating for a ceasefire deal and saying, like, it takes real courage to, he said, wave the white flag, which certainly sounds like surrender, you know, to have negotiations when you're losing and save lives that way. And the Biden administration announced another $300 million package of military aid to Ukraine. CNN reported they were able to fund this tranche through savings in weapons contracts, which is a reminder that literally no one understands the Pentagon budget. So,
But it's also a reminder, frankly, though, that $300 million is not $56 billion, which is a supplemental. So there's a huge gap between being able to kind of cobble together the workarounds versus actually funding this.
Yeah, as long as we're on sort of threats to democracy. Do you see that Trump is going to start getting intelligence briefings again now that he's a candidate?
I saw that, you know, I don't know why, you know, you feel the need to abide by norms, you know, that when you're running against this guy.
How does he have a clearance still?
When you steal classified documents and store them in your toilet.
And refuse to give them back.
And talk about them on tape to, like, you know, right-wing journalists at Mar-a-Lago. I would think that you would have a hard time getting the SF-86 clearance, you know. I mean, I guess there's a version of briefings that can change, right? There's one that has, like, sensitive information in it. And then there's like a cliff notes of, like, you know, here's the Pod Save the World version of the briefing. You know?
Yeah, a lot of open source.
Let's hope it's the cliff notes version.
Just summarizing Wall Street Journal articles.
The Vox, you know, thing. But yeah, I don't know why. What's the downside to saying no?
Zero.
Then Trump comes out and says, he won't give me intelligence briefings. And you just say, well,
you didn't read them when you were in the White House.
And you're literally under indictment for stealing classified secrets. So maybe we shouldn't give you classified secrets.
Yeah. Adam Schiff says he hopes the intel community will dumb them down. I think they already do that for the candidates, right? You get more of the over, you know, arching assessments than like the sensitive stuff.
That's
true. Still a bad idea.
Yeah, it's still a bad idea. Because he'll still come out and talk about it.
Yeah, and he'll probably try to hawk it to the drawer bun.
Yeah.
Before we go to break, two quick housekeeping items. First, Pod Save America is going on tour this year with the Democracy or Else Tour, a tour name inspired by the title of our new book. Going around the country, we're going to go to battleground states like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and more. Friends of the Pod get early access to tickets, so subscribe now at crooked.com/friends to get the exclusive presale code today. Run, don't walk, because the presale ends Friday the 15th at 9 a.m. local before tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. later that day to the broader public. Also, Ben, I got some exciting news. I'm getting the band back together with Roger Bennett from the Men in Blazers podcast. We are going to do season two of World Corrupt on a topic that I think you're going to like, which is Saudi Arabia gobbling up global soccer.
Oh, this like now you've got, you're really in a higher weight class than Qatar. I like this.
You know? More money, more influence, more bone saws.
Yeah.
We got it all here.
Maybe you won't get an angry CNN.com op-ed from the Qataris this time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, what I am actually kind of worried about is getting killed abroad.
Well, you know, but that's been a risk for us for a while.
Yeah. So make it worth my while. Listen to the trailer. It's out now. And then tune in every Saturday for new episodes of World Corrupt starting next week right here on the Pod Save the World feed. Pod Save the World is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Tis the month of St. Paddy's Day.
Can you do this in an Irish accent?
I don't even think I could. And here's a random related fact. What's the guy's name? The Taoiseach?
The Taoiseach, yeah.
Yeah, that's spelled so funny, I can never remember to say
it. I think
it's
the Taoiseach.
I think Joe Biden is also the Taoiseach. Currently.
He is, yeah.
Did you know the odds of finding a lucky four-leaf clover are 1 in 10,000?
Not if you could find a three-leaf clover and just split one of the clovers in half.
That's a good life hack. I don't think I've ever found a four-leaf clover.
No, me neither.
That's pretty difficult. By the way, that statistic, 1 in 10,000. But if you're a business owner or a hiring manager, you don't need the luck of the Irish to find top talent for your team.
You got close there. You got close.
ZipRecruiter is brilliant. We're from Boston. We're basically Irish. ZipRecruiter's brilliant technology leads you to a pot of gold of top talent. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology starts showing you qualified candidates for it. Once you review your list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply so they're more likely to apply sooner. Aren't you a wee bit curious to see how ZipRecruiter can help you? Well, today's your lucky day because you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/pod. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Once again, just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/pod. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Rocket Money. You heard of Rocket Money, John?
I sure have.
It's like it's not having a contract with Elon. You know what it is? What do you think Rocket Money will do? Is it will find any subscription you forgot
about. It's like what
about.
We're trying to do to Elon. Cancel. cancel subscription.
That's exactly right. Rocket Money can cancel a subscription for you. So if you've been subscribing to some streaming service that you never watch, or, you know, some magazine, God forbid,
magazine
that just comes to your house and you trash every day, Rocket Money will take care of it. And they've worked for me. It's worked for Ben Rhodes. I know you've used it too. Everyone in this office used it at this point. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills lower for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. That's a lot of money.
That ain't nothing.
That ain't nothing. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/world. That's rocketmoney.com/world. rocketmoney.com/world. All right, Ben, let's talk about TikTok. The House of Representatives is advancing a bill that would force ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, to sell all but 20% of TikTok to a U.S. company, or else it gets banned in the United States. So this bill passed, remember this, Ben, the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, so, best name. Yeah.
That's a thing that exists. Yeah, yeah. So the bill passed that committee by a vote of 50-0. Whoa, yeah, I wonder how it got through.
Yeah.
Biden says he supports the ban. Until recently, Trump also supported forcing an ownership change of TikTok. If you remember, back in 2020, he issued an executive order banning U.S. companies from transactions with ByteDance because they were worried it would give the Chinese government access to sensitive data on Americans. Seems reasonable concern. But just days before the full House of Representatives is supposed to vote on this new TikTok ban proposal, Trump flip-flopped. And he did it on Truth Social, saying, if you get rid of TikTok, Facebook, and Zucker Schmuck, we'll double their business.
Oh, God.
So
why does everything feel like 2016 again?
I hate it. We're trapped. We're trapped.
Yeah.
So
trapped time is a flat circle.
So Trump does hate Zucker Schmuck. That's well known. But a lot of people think that this change in policy might be good old-fashioned corruption or donor influence. So Trump met with a guy named Jeff Yass. I don't know if it's Yass. Jeff Yasqueen. He's a billionaire conservative. He gives tons of money to the Club for Growth.
Why did these people come out of the woodwork? There's always some billionaire MAGA guy that shows
okay.
up. You know.
This dude, so he funds the Club for Growth. He has a $20 billion stake in ByteDance. So he's got a lot of skin in the game. So Trump denies talking with Jeff Yass or Yes or whatever the name is about TikTok.
I'm sure. Yeah,
but yeah,
so
I mean, as you probably have heard from people I know, TikTok has bought up every lobbyist in Washington, including Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah.
So like a good mob boss, I'm sure, like the deals happening between the capos. Anyway, here's a clip of Trump talking about why he now opposes the TikTok ban during a recent interview with CNBC.
There are a lot of people on TikTok that love it. There are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. There are a lot of users. There's, you know, a lot of good, and there's a lot of bad with TikTok. But the thing I don't like is that without TikTok, you can make Facebook bigger. And I consider Facebook to be an enemy of the people, along with a lot of the media.
Oof.
Okay.
Just to round this out, the intelligence community in that global threat report that we talked about earlier mentioned TikTok. It says, quote, TikTok accounts run by PRC propaganda arm reportedly targeted candidates from both political parties during the U.S. midterm election cycle in 2022. And it added that China is demonstrating a higher degree of sophistication in its influence activity, including experimenting with generative AI. So stepping back, a lot of issues at play here. The first is national security and the Chinese government potentially being able to get our data or just control like the most important social media platform for young people in the U.S. The second is constitutionality and whether banning TikTok is actually a First Amendment violation. Just a lot of discussion there. And then there's just this good old influence peddling piece and this billionaire maybe buying off Trump's position. Any guess on what happened with Trump or what is going to happen going forward or whether you think this is a good idea?
Well, the guesses on what happened, it's probably a combination of, whatever billionaire is you know, made whatever deal with Trump.
I mean, Zucker schmucks.
Sometimes the thing that's obvious is what happened. Like, maybe there's some super PAC that's going to get a big contribution.
No doubt.
Some legal fees are going to be relieved. I don't know what the hell the corruption is, but I'm sure it's there.
And worth noting, Vivek Ramaswamy flip-flopped the exact same way.
Yeah.
He called it digital fentanyl TikTok, and then he got several million from this guy to his super PAC, and then
now
he was on
like
TikTok.
It's like digital cough medicine.
Yeah.
I think that also, interestingly, this time around, my... you know, anecdotal interactions suggest that maybe Trump is hearing from his campaign that TikTok is maybe good for him. You know, last time he didn't like TikTok because there were a lot of like resistance comedians making TikToks about Trump.
And, or K-pop fans.
Or K-pop fans
messing with his events.
This time around, I think you've got a lot of Gaza content that is understandably upsetting and angering the very younger voters that are turning off Joe Biden. I think, frankly, you have like a bunch of TikToks that make fun of Joe Biden for being old and stuff. And so maybe Trump's thinking like, well, actually, like TikTok might not be a net negative for me. It might be a net positive.
My explainer on the Dalai Lama didn't do that well. I don't know why.
Well,
my Uyghur genocide one didn't either.
Well, this gets to the thing I was going to say, which is, and don't at me, I know the TikTok, you know, brigades can be like the Swifties here. So I'm going to be very careful about how I state this. But again, the thing that is for years, what I've heard from the people that I, you know, look at this. TikTok, the algorithms that that drive what content people receive are a black box in China, essentially. And it is a platform in which what you receive is not as tied to who your followers are as other things, other platforms, right? Now, Meta, Instagram, Twitter have changed this as well recently, where suddenly you start to see stuff that's not... necessarily what you follow, but TikTok,
for you page.
TikTok, you're being fed a feed by algorithms that, you know, are nobody can see them except the ByteDance engineers in China, and that's a legitimate concern. Now, I don't think that the right outcome is banning it altogether, because frankly, I think in all this information space, one thing I've learned the last few years is like we're not going to like. Be able to turn back the clock to not having these platforms and not having disinformation campaigns. But I think there should be a real effort to try to get some transparency around how information flows on TikTok, how the algorithms work. The best way for that to happen is for there to be like a US-owned subsidiary where the all not only is the data stored in the US, but the algorithms are in the US.
That's where this is heading, seems.
I think that's a totally valid, you know, you don't have to be a member of the select committee on the Chinese Communist Party to think that maybe if young people in this country are being largely, you know, their number one information source is, you know, this platform and we don't really know how it works and it's emanating from a country that would want to fill young people in this country with division and anxiety, you know, that perhaps we should take a look at that.
And by the way, this is what the Chinese government
does
too.
The same thing.
They force you to open a Chinese subsidiary if you're like Airbnb and you want to operate in China.
Yeah.
I should say that, you know, it seemed like at the end of the Trump administration, they were trying to force a sale of TikTok to Oracle because I think Larry Ellison's a buddy. Ultimately, Oracle, I think they could cut this deal where they would just sort of store American data at a place in Texas. I think it was called Project Texas, actually. For what it's worth, there's been a bunch of reporting since that attempt at creating a firewall has completely failed. I think the Wall Street Journal had a great report on this. And this whole segment is drawn from great reporting by the Washington Post and CBS News and the Journal, by the way. But yeah, I mean, it does... In 2020, I felt like... the conversation on a ban was a little more reasonable and understandable. Now, 4 years later, you have people who've built like lives, careers, relationships
that's why
on this platform.
The best outcome is not a ban. But again, the two issues are data. And first of all, just on the data point, you know, the US will spend all this money spying on countries. Like, imagine if you just had the massive data set of all the likes and
interests,
you know, interest
location.
And, you know, anxieties of tens and tens of millions of Americans, like pretty good vehicle for data collection. So you want to be able to store the data in the US. And then again, you want to be able to understand how the platform is working through the algorithm. And so that's the best outcome to work for.
Yeah.
Not an outright ban, which I think would just piss people off. And frankly, then it'd just be replaced by some other similar platform.
Yeah, he's not wrong that Zucker schmucks.
the best line, no one will ever top the close of social network, Mark, You're not an asshole, so stop trying so hard to be one.
the other good Trump nickname the other day was Sloppinopolis.
I gotta say, he's getting his game back after sanctimonious,
sharpening up his knives.
Yeah, election year.
So we'll watch this one. The vote in the House should be on Wednesday, which is when this comes out. The Senate has sort of a different view, so we'll see if they can.
Yeah, I doubt this will get through.
Yeah. Ben, let's talk about some big political news coming out of Europe, starting in Portugal, which held snap elections on Sunday. So the headline out of these elections is that the far-right party, the Chega party, which translates to Enough Party, secured 18% of the vote despite being formed in 2019. According to the BBC, they ran on immigration and corruption. But, you know, they will not be able to form a government, but the takeaway should be that there's this growing strength with these far-right parties as we head into elections for the European Parliament in early June.
Yeah.
And then in Turkey, President Tayyip Erdogan told Reuters that the upcoming election on March 31st will be his last. Erdogan was recently reelected to a five-year term. That was in 2023. He's been president since 2014. Before that, he was prime minister for about a decade. So if he left the political scene, it would be a seismic moment, but I don't know. He's also a liar, so maybe we should doubt
his sincerity. I mean, on Erdogan, we'll see what he does. He's also kind of like his son-in-law. Like, he's got like a nepotism
pass it off,
structure set up, and so he still might be, you know, whenever he exits the formal scene, he still may be the kind of power behind things, so we'll have to see how things go. And yeah, the Portugal thing is in line with the kind of 20%, you know, window that we've seen for a lot of these far-right parties. It's obviously concerning. You made the right point. I think the barometer of the strength of the far right across the continent will be seen in these European parliamentary elections, because that's the rare election in Europe where everybody's voting, because they're voting for representation in Brussels. And that'll be a real test of strength. And then the next big test will be the French election, which is coming up relatively soon, where Marine Le Pen, you know, has a real shot too. So keep an eye on this, as always.
Scary one. Also, this reporting got me just kind of Googling around about Erdogan, seeing what he's been up to. On Saturday, he said that Turkey firmly backs Hamas. He said it's not a terrorist organization. And he added, quote, Netanyahu and his administration with their crimes against humanity in Gaza are writing their names next to Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin like today's Nazis. This isn't necessarily new rhetoric from Erdogan. He also said that he was going to host Vladimir Putin in Turkey after the Russian elections. But it is just wild that this guy's a member of NATO. He says things like this about Israeli government. He's welcoming Putin to town. I mean, just friends like these, man.
Well, what's so interesting about Erdogan, which we've talked about, is he'll veer back and forth. Like, he'll have his pro-Western quarter where he goes to NATO meetings and lets, you know, Sweden and Finland into NATO and does something that we like. And then all of a sudden he's got Putin there. So he just tacks back and forth. And what's interesting, stepping back, a lot of these kind of medium-sized powers are doing this more and more, where they're kind of shopping around, diversifying, you know, Turkey, Brazil, India, you know, they'll be buying Russian oil one day, and then they'll be at a
hedging some bets.
Yeah, they're hedging in all directions, right? And I think part of the reason they're hedging is, well, one, they can, you know, it's like a menu that they can shop from. What do I want from the Chinese? What do I want from the Russians? What do I want from the Americans and the Europeans? But the other thing is Trump. You know, I think everybody's kind of waiting to see what happens here. You know?
Yeah. Breaking news based on a text that I got a while ago, but I just read. Apparently, RFK Jr. said that his short list for running mates are Jesse Ventura, the mind Ventura.
Kind of like
pro wrestler
90s,
turned governor of Minnesota. He has been. Yeah. And then Aaron Rodgers, Ben.
Oh,
your quarterback, New York Jets quarterback.
Oh.
Care to comment? Care to comment on Aaron Rodgers?
Well, he'll probably blow out his Achilles
on the no jab ticket.
Yeah, when he's announced as VP, he'll blow out his Achilles walking out onto the stage.
His best day will be his first day.
Yeah, it is. This whole Joe Rogan wing of American society is endlessly fascinating to me. Actually, I saw Aaron Rodgers was recently on Joe Rogan.
The irony of the do your own research guys, not really seeming to do a lot of research.
Aaron Rodgers, not the kind of guy I want to do my research.
Bums me out. Okay, horrible news out of Nigeria, where over the past few weeks, hundreds of kids aged 8 to 15 years old have been kidnapped from several different schools by criminal gangs. It's just literally every parent's worst nightmare. Unfortunately, these kinds of mass abductions have been an ongoing issue for Nigeria. According to a report in Al Jazeera, 1,400 children have been abducted in Nigeria over the past decade. And then I'm sure a lot of listeners remember back in 2014 when the terrorist group Boko Haram abducted 276 schoolgirls from their dormitory. That led to the very well-meaning but ultimately unsuccessful Bring Back Our Girls social media campaign. To this day, about 100 of those girls are still missing. Hopefully, with these recent abductions, the outcome will be better, because unlike the incident with Boko Haram, these more recent abductions have been mostly kidnappings for ransom, where these, you know, militant, not even militant groups, sort of like gang groups, kidnap kids, ransom their families, return them months later, you know, at exorbitant costs. Nigerian President Tinubu, who was elected last year after running a campaign promising to end Nigeria's security challenges and end kidnapping, condemned the abduction, saying, quote, "The president directs security intelligence agencies to immediately rescue the victims and ensure that justice is served against the perpetrators of these abominable acts." The Nigerian military says, you know, they're trying, but they're spread too thin. They're unable to combat all of these armed groups and gangs who have been able to take over enormous swaths of territory and basically just torment everyone living there. So just an all around horrible situation that we wanted to highlight and something to watch.
Yeah. And I think the broader context to watch, right, is one of the reasons why. You know, I was down at South by Southwest with this International Crisis Group panel, and the head of the International Crisis Group, Comfort Arrow, was on with me, and she used to be the Africa director, and she was talking about the coups in Chad and Niger and Mali and unfortunately other places, and she made the point that one of the reasons why that has happened is you've had a breakdown in the big powers, like Nigeria has its own instability, which makes it harder to kind of be this stabilizing force in the region, at the same time that Libya and Algeria, which are above those coup countries, have had their own instability. Mm-hmm. The bigger point being that Nigeria is a little messy right now, and it always has had issues with violence and corruption. But given the fact that it's bordered by Niger and Chad, and it's the biggest country in Africa, the thing to watch is just, you know, does this kind of violence foreshadow or indicate like a larger growing instability, or is it manageable? You know, that's the thing I'd watch, in addition to obviously just the human cost.
And on top of that, I mean, last week we talked in depth about Sudan during the interview. Because of the civil war in Sudan, you have hundreds of thousands of people fleeing to other countries, including to Chad, which was already unstable, right? You had the president of Chad was killed a couple of years ago while visiting troops on the front line. His son took over. There's sort of questionable legitimacy. There's been all sorts of authoritarian things happening. But when you have flows of, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people into a country, it's going to completely destabilize it.
That's the thing, is this stuff can spread.
Yeah, it's spreading fast. This is not the important point, Ben, but Lovett recently pointed out to us that Mark Robinson, the right-wing nut job Republican nominee for governor of North Carolina, he's like a big Facebook guy, Facebooked a lot back in the day. In 2014, he weighed in on the Boko Haram abduction of the Nigerian schoolgirls. This is a thing he actually posted on Facebook. George Soros stole them girls, 11 exclamation points. This is a man who might be currently lieutenant governor of North Carolina.
He's already elected statewide. Yeah, this is an interesting guy.
11 exclamation points.
A lot of hot takes emanating
from
this guy.
My God.
Yeah.
Fucking lunatic. Okay, let's turn to Ireland, where an effort to update Ireland's constitution to make it less sexist somehow failed miserably. Here is the backstory. So Irish voters were asked to vote on two different amendments to the constitution. First, whether to replace language in the constitution about marriage being the foundation of a family and replace it with a clause designed to make the definition more inclusive. So it says that marriage and, quote, other durable relationships are the foundation of the family. Seems reasonable. The second thing they were asked to vote on was to remove language that said a woman's duties, quote unquote, should be in the home. That too.
Yeah. It's still a little odd, you know, constitutional provision there.
Real dated. Yeah. 1937 era language.
Yeah.
Also, 60% of Irish women already in the labor force, so it's ludicrous on its face. So organizers timed the vote on these two provisions to coincide with International Women's Day on March 8th, but both of the provisions went down. The change about women's duties was defeated with 73% of the vote, in part because the prime minister's proposed language wasn't what had been vetted by activist groups or citizens' assembly meetings. And the changes to the definition of family was defeated by 68% of the vote, in part because conservative activist groups said that it could impact land inheritance rights somehow. I don't understand all of this. Turnout was low. Voters were confused. The campaigning was bad. So good news, a better run campaign seems like it could get this done.
Yeah.
Bad news, until then, Ireland is stuck with this 1937 constitution.
Yeah. No, I it sounds like this was just a poorly done campaign up against, you know, probably galvanized opposition. But, you know, I mean, it speaks to the need to, like, you know, when you take your shot.
Politics matters, man.
Yeah, when you take your shot, you really got to aim and fire. You can't just think that the obvious rightness of your cause is going to carry across the goal line here. But I'm hopeful, you know, I love the Irish. Still figure it out. I have confidence in the Irish.
Now, we do need to wonder why I constantly pivot us from stories about Ireland into royal stories. I don't know that that's the best tick I have. But here we go.
Well, it's, I mean, like, give the people what they want,
okay,
including me, because I want to talk about this.
So you're our official royal correspondent.
Yeah.
That said, thus far we have avoided covering the stories about where is Kate Middleton. In part, at least to me, it felt like an instance of the internet being shitty to a person who was probably dealing with a health issue.
Yeah.
But now, bad Photoshop has forced our hand. I regret to inform you that we have to cover this. So here's what we know. Kate Middleton has not been seen in public since Christmas of last year. She had a scheduled abdominal surgery on January 17th. On January 29th, Kensington Palace announced she had returned home, but she's not returned to official duty since. Then her husband canceled an event in late February, and it, like, set the internet on fire, and people started speculating about where they might be or what happened to her. On March 10th, the palace released a photo of Kate with her children for British Mother's Day. The second it emerged, internet sleuths said that is Photoshopped, and it was Photoshopped very poorly, to the point where the Associated Press had to retract the photo, saying, quote, the photo shows an inconsistency in the alignment of Princess Charlotte's left hand. That was not the only inconsistency. There's Prince Charlotte missing part of her wrist, seemingly. Kate isn't wearing her wedding ring, and it looks like her arms are like 100 feet long.
Yeah, do you notice that part?
Yeah. Maybe that's just me.
No, no, that's that you just took one of my takes.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. She's like Gumby arms. The zipper on Kate's jacket doesn't line up. There's blooms on the trees in the background that just obviously don't match the time of the year. There's some people who even believe that Kate's face in the photo was directly lifted from an old Vogue cover shoot. The tweet laying out that theory got us 46 million views at this point. It could also be the case that the face in the Vogue shoot looks like the face in the photo, because that's what her face looks like. But who am I to judge? Yesterday, Kate tweeted, Ben, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused. Vox had a big analysis of all this, as they do. He talked about Kate's reliability and how weird it is for her not to show up, because she always shows up.
She's supposed to be the reliable one.
She is the, So, I don't know, man. This woman, she posed for the paparazzi 24 hours after giving birth several times. She doesn't owe those fucking assholes anything. I have to admit that I didn't really care about this until I saw the hilarious Photoshop memes. But what's your take? What's happening here?
All right. I mean, I have a lot to say about this. Because there's a lot. There's so many, like,
crack another drink.
So
listeners.
But there's so many dimensions to this. Okay. So first of all, the explanation is kind of insane, right? Because
that she herself was editing this.
First of all, they insist on telling us that William took this picture, right? Which is kind of strange. These people have other people that can take pictures.
Right. Just surrounded by staff.
And then her like everybody else, I wanted to play around with this. When I play around with a photo, I don't make my arms like twice as long and cut out parts of my kid's wrist and hands. And, you know, I change the filter, you know, I crop it a little bit. Like, why would you edit your photo to make it weird and to remove body parts? And, you know,
I think what the theory is that sometimes there's photos, a lot of people do this where, like, you take a photo of six people in a family, three of them look good, three look bad. So you grab faces from other photos and put them on.
Do you? Is that a thing?
That's
kind of weird.
Yeah, it's weird.
But they didn't just change your face. Like, do you change your arms when you do that?
Gumby arms are sexy.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, so that's first thing. Second thing is, small comment, but, like, I remember when I was reading this, like, the Associated Press just describes revoking a photo as a kill notification.
Yeah, it seemed a little over the top,
huh? It was a little aggressive. Like, we have issued a kill notification on the Kate Middleton photo. I was like, who are these people at the Associated Press? You know? Okay, so we're just going to go into totally irresponsible speculation, right?
I live there.
Because basically, what are, like, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out the conspiracy theories, right? So there's the conspiracy theory. The sad one, right, that she has like a real health issue and just is being really super, like Lloyd Austin about it, right? Mm-hmm. This is like a Lloyd Austin situation, except a little bit longer.
And also in a job where your appearance is constantly judged and nitpicked in the most cruel way possible.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So you may not just want to deal with that if you're going through some shit. And that, if that's the case, like that makes a lot of sense. You know, the internet, like internet sleuths, as you'd mm-hmm. say, you know, there are all these other theories. Like, is their marriage in trouble? Like, is William up to no good? Like, there are all these things that, you know, speak to the royal family's endless penchant for gossip. What I will say about this is, number one, can we get some better communications people at the palace, though? Because, like, the communication strategy around this, like, whatever the answer is, they are not getting good advice here.
You know, no.
like from putting out the doctored photo to kind of being totally opaque about this. And I'm always sensitive, you know, like maybe it's not their fault. Maybe they're just getting rolled by crazy principals. We've all been there too. But so whether the fault is with the royals themselves or with the staff, like there does need to be some transparency here. Like they're subsidized, but I mean, everybody rightly points out it sucks for these people that they get photographed. They also get to live in a bunch of palaces and be billionaires without doing anything other than like showing up at ribbon cuttings.
Right,
so
it seems sweet.
It seems like there's a need to just be a little transparent. And then my hottest take here, Tommy, is, man, like the Queen seemed to be holding this whole operation together. You know,
there is a lot of
like
that
was like the appearance for years was like, it seems like the Queen is really like the boss. They called it the firm and she's kind of the senior partner. You know, Queen exits the stage and it's like all hell's breaking loose. You know, like Harry's got books coming out about fist fights with his brother. He and Meghan are still hanging out in Santa Barbara. Kate can't be seen, like not sure what William's up to. Charles doing his best, but poor Charles now has
diagnosed with cancer.
Has cancer, and we don't know how serious that is. You know, like so, it just feels
or even
like
or even what kind of cancer.
Yes, yeah, we just don't know. Yeah, so just the you know, it's not looking great over there.
No, it's scary. All we know is that Charles does not have prostate cancer. We don't know what's going on. So there is a real like line of succession issue.
And they probably know. I mean, this whole thing, they just need to be a little more. Transparency is always your friend in communications.
Yeah. So what happens next? I mean, I guess you just have to figure out a time when you bring in
the interview,
one friendly media
member.
Don't
you think? I mean, now I'll ask you the question as a communications strategist extraordinaire. I mean, is the answer here like a sit down interview where they're holding hands? Is the answer like, a carefully managed, like, you know, documentary? Mm. Is it like a written thing? Like, what do you do here?
Well, obviously, Pod Save the World would be number one.
Yeah.
Two, imagine if they had a sense of humor and they just started putting out hilariously photoshopped.
There you go. That's the other way to go.
Fucking Snapchat filter videos all over their Instagram.
Yeah, like
you have so much fun with this.
My daughter, when I FaceTime her now, has figured out, you know, how to put like a lizard head on or an alien head. You could do that, you know.
Yeah, Lizette really. Really, really likes FaceTime, but likes to grab the camera and kind of like, and sometimes wonders, like when my mom was here in person, was sort of wondering why she wasn't in the phone, I think.
Well, I have to say, like, no, my wife's gonna kill me for this, but like, so my daughter likes to do the animal heads, but the other day I was talking to her and like, half the conversation, she's got the turd head. And I'm just like, come on. I'm like, can we just change? Can we go back to like the dinosaur head?
Something
or
cute.
The cute dog head? You know, like this is not good.
Yeah.
But they could do that. Kate could, you know, be like, call a press conference online and do that.
It would be so funny.
And that would be funny.
Just release a bunch of terrible Photoshops.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully there's not something serious underpinning this.
No. Yeah.
Like
the
best case, right, is she like got a nose job or some sort of elective surgery. You know, like hopefully it's something.
No,
like
we should be clear. Like I've always liked Kate, you know, and she seemed like The Rock, right? So that's why people are a little, you know, unsteady about this.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
John Cena, naked. Did you see that, by the way?
That was a lot.
That was a lot. Yes. Like
it's always weird when people have like Audi abs. Like your abs are so ripped, they kind of extend outward. John Cena?
Yeah.
You know? You know what I'm saying, Alona? He's just so ripped. It's like, what's happening?
I feel like we made Alona laugh today more than
I think she was just coughing.
It's a wishful thinking.
Right? I don't know.
But yeah, like unfortunately, the best explanation would be the worst news, which is that she's really dealing with some issues, and we hope that's not the case. And if it's not the case, yeah, then do your advice.
Everyone is entitled to their privacy about all things medical. So yeah. I could imagine why you wouldn't want to release information before you're ready. I mean, that's basically what happened to Lloyd Austin, right? He got this scary news about his health. He didn't want to put it out there. Yeah. He's a very private person, whatever. But when you're in these public positions, you kind of know that you don't know that this level of crazy is going to happen. But, you know, when you're a royal, you know what the paparazzi does and the amount of speculation, and there's this whole cottage industry built around you.
Well, and as Royal Observer, you know, part of what Kate's usually been very good at this. Like, Kate has been the one who's handled this, like, you know, very elegantly for a very long time. So, so that does make you worry that there's something not great going on.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean,
yeah, who knows? Okay, well, that's all the speculation from us. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you will hear Ben's interview with Renata Segura about the situation in Haiti. So please stick around for that.
The constant political chaos can be a lot. You got to mix it up with a little regular chaos. Go behind the pods with Terminally Online, Cricket's loosest show, where the news takes a backseat to the unscripted antics of your favorite Pod Save America and Cricket Media hosts and staffers. Here, love it, learning about dating apps.
I was single in my 20s, and then yada, 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 I was single in my 40s.
Listen to my sage advice on being kind to retail workers. Just smile, walk away. You don't have a right to be an asshole. And enjoy Tommy celebrating the unrelenting wheel of time.
Time comes for all of us. You will all be out of touch with the culture. You'll all be asking someone what some equivalent of a Yassified means.
Terminally Online is a subscriber-exclusive show. To get access, subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community at cricket.com/friends.
So last week we talked about the situation in Haiti after armed gangs kind of banded together, stormed prisons, released thousands of inmates, fought with police. The prime minister had been in Kenya trying to finalize a deal for Kenyan police forces to come to Haiti, but then he was prevented from returning to the country. And now the prime minister has officially resigned following a transition council being established. The U.S. military is helping to airlift non-essential staff from the U.S. embassy. Other countries have done the same. So it's a very chaotic situation. Thankfully, to help us shed light on the situation today is Renata Segura, who is the deputy program director for the International Crisis Group in Latin America and the Caribbean. ICG is obviously a tremendous organization that has helped us make sense of difficult events in the past. So Renata, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Okay, so you and your team have done a lot of reporting on the situation in Haiti. How would you describe for people that are not following it that closely, just what has been going on in the last few days and weeks? What are the major players and what do they want? Why are they making this move right now, the gangs?
So we have seen a radical change of strategy and really of what's happening in Haiti since last Sunday, a week ago. Essentially, since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021, we have seen a strengthening of the gangs. We should probably note that gangs have been historically a feature of Haitian politics for a very, very long time, for decades. And they had been a sort of private army for either political or commercial elites that have used them to further their interests. After the assassination of Moïse, we have seen that these gangs had been strengthening. They had been gaining more and more territorial control. And we have also seen some separation between these elites and the gangs, in part because of the sanctions that have been imposed, particularly by Canada, on several very high-profile politicians, including ex-president Martelly, Lee, that had sort of sent a message on to some of the elites that they shouldn't continue supporting the gangs, at least not so openly. So with that, we had seen a shift in the way in which the gangs had been operating, and they had transferred their attention to really extort private companies and individuals, and also kidnapping. And they were doing that to make up for the lost revenues that they were not being, they weren't receiving from these elites. However, until very recently, what we had seen was a confrontation between gangs, right? G9 and GPEP, which are the two biggest coalitions, were fighting each other to more territory, and more territory obviously means more power and more money. However, as Crisis Group noted in the report that we published last January, there had been a building of a coalition between the gangs, something that Cherissier, one of the most notorious gang leaders, has called Vive Ensemble, which in Creole means living together. This was a very short-lived coalition last fall, in which he had said, for the good of the people, we're going to stop fighting. That fell apart very quickly. However, we knew from sources in the ground that the gang leaders kept communications lines open, and that they were thinking that they could bring together this coalition again if the multinational support mission that was approved by the UN and is being led by Kenya was to arrive, or eventually to fight the state. And so that is what has been happening in the last week. So we have gone from a scenario in which gangs were fighting each other, and now we have a scenario in which gangs are allied together fighting the state. This has been obviously a message for Henry, who, as you noted, was out of the country, and they were asking for his resignation. But we very much think it was also a message for the Kenyans. And they were saying, we are going to be a force to be reckoned with if you decide to come. And so that is the situation where we are today, with the gangs allied, you know, ready to confront a multinational support mission if it is to arrive, and searching to expand to control. At this point, almost they have the majority of the city, and they could soon control 100% of Port-au-Prince, and then likely expand to the rest of the country.
Okay, well, that's quite clear. So essentially, the Prime Minister Henry goes to Kenya to kind of finalize this mission, and so the gangs make the move while he's out of the country to prevent that Kenyan mission from coming in, and they seem to have succeeded in doing that in the short term, and also may have succeeded in, you know, preventing Prime Minister Henry from kind of resuming whatever governing authority he had, which is probably not much to begin with. Before we get into kind of what the options are for dealing with this situation, I just want to ask, from the reporting that your team has done, you know, when we look at this from the outside, we see kidnappings, we see, you know, people being killed. What do you have any sense of what life is like for just ordinary people on the ground in Port-au-Prince in this circumstance?
Yes, I mean, it has been very, very difficult until now, and it has just increasingly worsened in the last week. So until let's say 2 weeks ago, controlled by the gangs. So people would only be able to leave their neighborhood to go to work, for example, if they had permission from the gangs. The gangs were also very interested in having people stay in the territories they controlled, you know, like even though there's hundreds of thousands of displaced people in Haiti at the moment, the gangs were trying to prevent that from happening. So, for example, if a family has three people that work, only one person will be able to leave the neighborhood. There was incredible amounts of sexual violence that being exerted. Women were being forced to be sexual partners of the gangs. And there was obviously a humanitarian situation in terms of access to food, to health services. Schools have been closed for a very long time. And with a crumbling state, essentially no protection services were being offered. That has only been made worse in the last week, because particularly access to gasoline is incredibly important in Haiti. Most homes in Haiti don't have electricity, and they depend on plants that are run by gasoline. People have not been able to leave their houses to get gasoline. So that means they don't have electricity, and the majority of the people also have water plants, because there's no potable water that comes into their houses. And people are running out of food. But when you leave the house, there's so much violence on the street that you really are risking your life. So what we're seeing is that people have been inside and they're running out of food. And for those people that have been hurt by the violence that is occurring on the streets, there's almost no health services. The gangs have ransacked the biggest hospitals. Doctors Without Borders and other international organizations have small clinics, but they are clearly overwhelmed. Not to mention people just have regular medical emergencies that need to be attended, women that are pregnant, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Haiti had already a humanitarian emergency in terms of food. More than half of the country needed food assistance, 30% in what the World Food Program calls critical access. And that is just gone through the roof in the last week. So it's really nightmare scenario what we have right now.
So, I mean, you know, what you're describing sounds like both the definition of a failed state, essentially, with gangs having more power than any governing authority, and a humanitarian catastrophe that could get worse as people lack food and water, potable water. You know, even the proposals that are now on hold of having, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 largely Kenyan police come in to support what is already a pretty small, I think under 10,000 active duty police in Haiti, it feels insufficient to deal with the scale of the challenge you describe. I mean, what kind of recommendations has Crisis Group made, and what do you think the international community should be thinking about in terms of options for dealing with the situation?
Yes, the situation is very dire, and the announcement of the Kenyans that they are going to put pause until there is a more clear governance structure in place in Haiti does make the situation very complicated. I mean, for very understandable reasons, Haitians have been very reluctant to international forces coming into the country, right? There is a long history from colonial times to invasions by the U.S., by through the sort of checkered results of MINUSTAH, et cetera, that have left people with a very sour taste. However, at this precise moment, because the situation is so dire, most of the Haitians that we have spoken to are very, very supportive of the idea of the mission. And really what we are hearing from Haiti today is true panic at the sense that nobody is going to come and help. Simultaneously, the U.S. has made it very clear that they are not keen on sending troops, at least not at the moment. I would imagine that if boatloads of Haitian migrants start arriving in Florida, that might change the calculation. But at this point, it isn't. What we're hoping is that this governance structure that was proposed or that came out of the meeting in CARICOM yesterday sort of takes place quickly. And then the Kenyans feel that they do have a counterpart in Haiti that would be sufficient. And that the Kenyans get some sort of support from other donor troop contributor countries and are able to land in the country. I mean, obviously, the idea of an invasion by U.S. security forces seems like not really a recommendable notion, but the fact that the security situation is such as what we're seeing right now, it also it's a tremendous challenge for the Kenyans, who are sending, let's remember, police and not military. What it was supposed to be a mission that was going to go into the neighborhoods to gain control of roads, of, you know, safeguarding state structures, has now turned into something more complicated. So it seems unlikely that they are going to be able to successfully do the work against the gangs unless they are accompanied by a more robust military force, even if just temporarily, to allow them to settle into the country. Simultaneously, however, we do think it is very important to keep lines of communications with the gangs open. And I think it is important to make a distinction here, right? Cherisier, who has become sort of the, does have political ambitions himself. He has hoped to be part of government in the past, and I'm sure he would be hoping that they would be included in this new transitional government. That seems really far-fetched, and I don't think neither the Haitians nor the international community would really be supportive of that idea. However, there are multiple people in Haiti, because the gangs have existed for so long, they have good channels of communication to them. And we're talking about local people, you know, members of the church, local leaders that have been negotiating humanitarian access in certain neighborhoods, that have been, you know, helping with specific people movement, etc. Those channels of communication are vital at this moment to negotiate with the gangs some sort of violence reduction, particularly to protect the population, but also to eventually allow this new government to take shape. Obviously, the gangs have the upper hand at this moment, and so it's going to be very difficult to convince them to step down. But if they were to see a force that comes that looks strong enough, that it will really, you know, give them a run for their money, I think there will be a bit of intimidation. It's difficult to know, because right now there's almost no counterpart for the gangs to know how strong they would be if they were faced with a well-trained force such as the one that Kenya has. Benin has also offered troops, etc., right? It's a different calculation to see them now when they have the run of the place vis-a-vis what would be the case if there was some serious security forces that would be facing them. So what we're hoping is that there could be a two-pronged approach. Clearly, a security intervention is at this point the only solution to at least bring the violence down a little bit. But also we're hoping that the local government and also hopefully the international community do keep these lines of communication open and try and convince the gang leadership that it is in their best interest to lower the violence, particularly against the communities.
So it sounds like, you know, what you're saying is there needs to be probably a bigger international force than even the Kenyan contingent in order to both try to stabilize things and maybe to create a basis for some negotiation with the gangs. Right now, there's no reason for the gangs to negotiate if they have control. Another part of this equation, as you mentioned, is the political structure in Haiti itself. The U.S. government had kind of supported the idea of a transition from Prime Minister Henri. The U.S. State Department urged a transition so as to facilitate a multinational security mission. You mentioned CARICOM, the Caribbean countries meeting to try to work through what a transition might look like. I mean, if Prime Minister Henri seems like he's moving out of the picture here, what do you think the kind of transition plan should be for Haiti's government? Is it even feasible? Because the U.S. always ties these things to elections, but you know, elections sometimes don't solve any problems. They just kind of create another vehicle for unrest and instability. I mean, how do you see the political situation that is required in Haiti going forward to make this work?
I mean, I think what came out of the CARICOM meeting yesterday is promising, and it's something that could work. Understanding that Henry is out of the picture, it's sort of unfortunate that it has taken this long for Henry to accept to resign. I think this is the sort of main structure of what was agreed yesterday in Jamaica is the main structure that has been discussed in political negotiations in Haiti for the last almost 2 years. So this is not incredibly innovative. And what it does, it sort of echoes the structures that are created by the Haitian constitution. So we're talking about what they're calling a presidential council, which will be for now a replacement of the president, right? We don't have a president. So this presidential council will have 7 people. And those people will be representatives both of the main political groups or the main political alliances, but also private sector and key civil society groups such as the Montana Accord, which has been kind of the leading voice of the opposition coming from civil society. So that would be one part of the government. And then once that presidential council is formed, they will come together and appoint a prime minister, and that prime minister will appoint a its cabinet. And so that sort of presidential council, prime minister, and cabinet would be the transitional government. I think that calling for elections at this point would be completely insane. There hasn't been electoral authorities in Haiti for a long time. From the technical perspective, it would be almost impossible to know where people are that they could come to the voting polls. And we have seen in the past how poorly prepared elections have actually not helped. They've been very detrimental for the stability of Haiti. So running into an election of that sort would be a mistake. However, we do have a transitional government that represents the majority. It's never going to represent every single Haitian, right? But if it does represent the majority of the political and social forces of Haiti, and it can work together to bring the mission and to work with foreign partners to try and address the security and humanitarian situation, then at least that will be a start. It's not going to be easy. Haitians have been fighting on the small, what are the details of what these governments should look like for a long time. CARICOM had asked them to bring forward a proposal and they couldn't get together. They couldn't agree on one, so they ended up sending 7 proposals to CARICOM, and it was only yesterday when in Jamaica everybody locked their doors, called people on Zoom, and was like, we have to come up with one agreement and that's it, and nobody leaves until we do that. It is too bad that it had to become such a terrible crisis before everybody came to the table with the willingness to make these kinds of compromises. But hopefully now there is an understanding of what would be a terrible risk if this government doesn't work, and that it's really the only way forward for Haiti to be able to start addressing the other two terrible crises that it has. So we're hopeful that within the next day or two we should have the names of who are people that are going to be part of the Presidential Council, and soon thereafter the name of the new Prime Minister.
So last question. I mean, part of what you're describing, what's interesting here is you have lots of different countries playing a role here. You've got CARICOM, the Caribbean neighbors of Haiti. You've got Kenya and Benin potentially providing these troops or police. You obviously have the Haitians themselves. In terms of the U.S., which is now drawing down part of our embassy, has this very complicated and often bad history of intervention in Haitian politics, but has more resources than anybody else in the hemisphere, well, the world, really. What do you recommend the U.S. policy be going forward? Where can the U.S. try to help in this circumstance?
I mean, I think obviously speeding the support to the multinational support mission is going to be crucially important. We know that's not, the government's prerogative exclusively, and some of this money has been stuck in Congress and it hasn't been approved. So that is problematic. But really trying to solve that issue and find ways to bring the key equipment that the Kenyans need and the support, be it in kind or in cash, is hugely relevant. I think for the U.S., and they're not the only actor, they're used to only working with their institutional counterparts, right? And they were very attached to Henry as a counterpart because it made sense, right? He had been appointed with a kind of iffy process, but a little bit of legitimacy. But there needs to be an understanding that the social forces in Haiti go beyond the institutions, and that with such a state in crumbles, there needs to be consultation that is very wide and open. And that's something that hadn't happened. The international community was very reluctant to engage with civil society in Haiti for a very long time, honestly, for way too long. And that was part of what dragged this political crisis that long. So I think from now on, understanding that what's happening in Haiti is very different than what's happening in other parts of the world, and that there needs to be an engagement with social forces too, will be key.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think there is one thing that has been incredibly important, and that we've been honing on this for a long time, but nothing has happened, is that a lot of the weapons that are being used by the Haitian gangs come from the United States. And they come mostly from Florida. They are purchased in the States, and then they are hidden in the cargo that takes other products into Haiti. And this is a relatively easy problem to solve.
Yeah.
It's one that for some reason, I think we can only imagine what is the political reason behind the reluctance to get involved in that. There's been very little action on the parts of the states. But at this point, if the gangs are not receiving new weapons, if they're not receiving particularly more ammunition, the equation on the ground would change dramatically. And this is something that it would not be very, very costly, and it would be actually fairly feasible for the United States to do right away. I think experts have identified out of what ports these guns are leaving Florida. And so that should be really straightforward. And we're hoping that this tremendous crisis is what finally pushes the American government to do that.
Well, in a sane world, we would not have guns, weapons of war for sale across the United States. But in a world where we do, the least we could do is try to stop those weapons from moving to Haiti. Look, thank you so much for giving us so much information. We really appreciate it. And hopefully people will listen to the recommendations coming from Crisis Group on this. So again, thanks for your work, and we'll keep in touch on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Renata Segura for joining the show. And Aaron Rodgers, man, I don't know. Might be a better VP than a quarterback these days.
Yeah, we might need a kill notification on that one.
It's like, I can't believe they called it a kill notification. I kept reading that story.
It's really jarring.
It's just
a Photoshop, guys.
Just not printing the photo because they have weird fingers. Yeah. Weird sausage hands. Anyway, that's it for us. Talk to you guys next week. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. And if you're as opinionated as us, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Reed Cherlin. Our producer is Alona Minkowski, and associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick, audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our studio technician is David Tolles. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Phoebe Bradford, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld.